You're listening to the Your Queer Story podcast, the podcast that inspires peace, love, and radicalism, led by your favorite hosts, Evan Jones and Paul Hobbs.
Trigger warning. Our content covers centuries of LGBTQ plus stories, and occasionally we may use outdated language or cover topics that include violence, assault, homophobia, transphobia, as well as other injustices against marginalized communities.
Make sure you subscribe and review wherever you are listening, and be sure to follow us on all social media at Your Queer Story.
And if you want exclusive content, join us on Patreon at patreon.com/yourqueerstory.
You're here, now let's get queer.
Welcome to the Your Queer Story podcast. We have a special edition for you. I am Evan Jones, and
I'm Paul Hobbs, and with us we have the legendary
Jim Obergefell. Am I still doing the O right? I know it's got to be a long O.
You got it great.
I got it great. You're welcome to correct me. Paul and I are really horrible with names, and I have listened to your name on a loop for about 3 weeks now, and that's not a lie.
There's just something about, I don't know if it's because we're from the Midwest or something, but like pronunciation just is not our strong point.
Well, he's also from the Midwest, so I don't think we can blame that on our Midwest roots.
True. True, but I also used to teach German, so okay. It comes naturally to me.
There you go. There you go. That's true.
Not to mention it's my name.
So you've had a little practice with it. That makes sense.
Just a bit.
Yeah. So Paul and I are actually both from Indiana, not right outside of Ohio, but you know, everything in that area is like all kind of grouped together. Mm-hmm. You were born in Sandusky, Ohio, right?
That's correct. Home of Cedar Point.
That's right. Oh, I spent many times at Cedar Point. Did you spend a lot of time at the amusement park there?
Surprisingly, no. I think I went maybe once a year growing up. And I always felt like my family, you know, I'm the baby of six. I felt like we were strange because not one of us actually worked at Cedar Point. And it seemed like everybody else in Sandusky did.
Yeah. Yeah. What's weird is that I also went like once a year, but we would travel down there. It was a bit of a trip for us. But we were like, I don't know, 4 hours away from there, and we managed to go down. But that's what happens whenever you've got a fun attraction near you. Everyone thinks you're always there, and you're not. Yep. And then if you don't live near it, you're going out of your way to get there.
So true.
So we're going to dive into history and everything. And if you are wondering where the name Obergefell comes from, it is from the landmark 2015 Supreme Court ruling that overturned the ban on same-sex marriage, and it is why we as LGBTQ people have the right to marry today.
And also the reason why I will be able to get married to my fiance whenever we're able to schedule that.
Yeah. His reasons are just that he's got to get around to scheduling. So, Jim, you grew up in Ohio. Were you in Ohio all of your life? Did you leave to go to school, or was that everything?
Pretty much my entire life. When I went to college, I went to the University of Cincinnati. So I stayed in Ohio, just 4 hours away. I did live in Washington, D.C. for a few years following the decision, because I just wanted a change of pace, and D.C. seemed like a good place to be.
Yeah.
But now I'm back in Ohio.
Now you're back? Mm-hmm. All right. I'm excited to talk about what brought you back to Ohio. Was your late husband, John, was also born and raised in Ohio? Was that the same situation with him?
No, he was actually born in Chicago, but both of his parents were from the greater Cincinnati area, actually northern Kentucky. But when John was seven, they decided to move back to Cincinnati. So John liked to say, I'll claim I'm from Ohio or from Chicago, depending on the conversation.
Hey, I totally get that, because I'm the same way. I'm either from Chicago or I'm from Rhode Island. It depends on who I'm talking to.
Yeah, we live like 45 minutes outside of Chicago. So you just tell people you're from Chicago because they don't know anything
else. It's a whole lot easier, right?
Exactly.
Did you two ever go to Chicago for trips or visits? Do you go to any of the Pride parades during that time?
Never Pride, but John did take me to Chicago, I think within our first year, or actually the first 6 months of being together, to see the musical Miss Saigon. It was one of his favorites, and he wanted me to experience it. So we did go to Chicago for that, and a few other times after that, including with our foreign exchange students.
Oh, yeah.
Wow, that's fun.
I got to see Miss Saigon here in Providence, not in Chicago, but I got to see Miss Saigon a couple years ago for the first time. It's a really great, beautiful play. So when you were growing up, around that time, I don't know the exact date, but I know that it was talked about in your book, Love Wins. A little plug for that. Check it out. but it was talked about in your book and a couple other areas. Now, Cincinnati was voted at one time or declared at one time the most anti-gay place in America. And was this the time that you and John were living there together? Was this when you were younger? And what was it like growing up in an environment that, you know, was considered so hostile by other people?
You know, it wasn't easy or fun. I moved to Cincinnati in 84, and I didn't come out until 92. So I would say the 80s, early 90s, I knew Cincinnati wasn't necessarily a great place for the LGBTQ plus community. But because I wasn't out, because I wasn't even open to coming out, it never felt incredibly personal to me because I wasn't living it as an open gay man. But, you know, the police would target men in city parks and set them up and arrest them. And then the big thing that happened was the Mapplethorpe exhibition at the Contemporary Arts Center in the early 90s. The director of that museum was brought up on public obscenity charges. And that's right around the time John and I first got together. And that was a chilling time to be in Cincinnati for the LGBTQ plus community and the arts. Thankfully, he was acquitted. But then it was also around the same time that city council passed a human rights ordinance that included the LGBTQ plus community. I think that happened in 1990. And there was a backlash, which resulted in a ballot issue. And our fellow Cincinnatians, our neighbors, passed this ballot issue, which updated the city charter to say that no laws could be passed to protect the LGBTQ plus community. So it's vastly different to say you live in a city that has no anti-discrimination protections to say, not only do we not have anti-discrimination protections, we can never have them because the city constitution, the city charter says that can never happen. It was a terrible place to live.
How ridiculous that they pass a law that says you can't pass a law to protect a group of people. That's probably one of the craziest things I've ever heard of.
Right. You know, Esquire magazine dubbed Cincinnati the town without pity. And I often like to say it was the most gay, unfriendly city in the nation. But L. Gerhard Stein, our attorney for the case that went to the Supreme Court, I much prefer the way he describes it. He says that Cincinnati was hostile to the LGBTQ plus community. And I think that's a much more accurate way to put it than just gay, unfriendly.
I totally agree.
Yeah. What now, like you said, you came out in 92, and then did you, how long had you been out before you met John or started to date John?
Well, let's see. The first time I met John was before I came out, and I was out with a friend who's actually one of John's friends, which I didn't know. And we walked into a bar. It wasn't a campus bar, but it was near the university. And all three of us had graduated from the University of Cincinnati. And Kevin and I walked into this bar, and Kevin said, oh, there's my friend Jar sitting at the bar, my friend John sitting at the bar. And John scared the daylights out of me because he was so comfortable in who he was as an out gay man. I thought for sure he would see right through me and call me out because I was still closeted. So that was the first time we met. The second time we met was a couple months later. I had come out. I was in graduate school in Bowling Green, Northwestern Ohio, but I was back in Cincinnati with Kevin. We went back to that same bar. And one guest who was at the bar having a gin and tonic, just like the first time, but John. So we started talking. And at one point, John said, well, you'd never go out with someone like me. And I have no idea where I came up with the wit or the courage to respond the way I did. But I said, how do you know? You've never asked. And he still didn't. So a couple months later, I'm back in Cincinnati for the holidays. And by this point, Kevin was one of John's housemates, and they were having a New Year's Eve party. And Kevin invited me. It was at John's house. I went to that party, and I never left.
That's awesome.
That's a beautiful story. And it's just interesting how, if you call it fate or whatever you call it, you just kept being brought together. And it was like shoving it in your face, but in a good way of like, hey, you too, wake up.
It's meant to be.
Exactly.
Open your eyes.
Happens that way. Mm-hmm. So being young and in love in Cincinnati, I mean, I know that like when I came out in Indiana, I wasn't really aware of what laws were, you know, had been made against us and what protections we did or didn't have. I just was trying to survive at that point. So were you aware of the hostility at that time, or is that more looking back on it and seeing how things were?
We were certainly aware of it, but we also started our relationship during the campaign for that charter amendment. And the only thing I had ever done remotely activism-like was during that election, I stood outside of the polling place in our neighborhood with others asking voters to vote against it. So we started our relationship in the midst of that horrible time in Cincinnati.
That must have been so scary because you're not only newly out, you're also confronting the hate, you know, face on in public to these people who are potentially going to vote against you.
Right. It was scary. It was certainly not fun. But I also have to say, John and I were fortunate in that our very large circle of friends, our family, we had all of the support and love that we could have asked for from them. So that helped make it easier for us. And I think the fact that, as John liked to put it, we were never our own personal pride parade, we fit into the idea of what two young white men should look like and how they should act in Cincinnati. So we were fortunate. I can't think of any direct discrimination we experienced.
Mm-hmm. Well, like you said, I mean, if you fit a mold or if it seems that you're following the rules, people will often leave you alone. I do think the point you made about support is so important because we see radical differences between queer young people that have supportive family members and queer young people that don't. And the difference that makes in how you're able to accept yourself and in how you're able to live in your communities.
Absolutely.
Right. It truly can be a life or death situation.
Mm-hmm. So speaking on like, you know, this idea of self-acceptance and self-love and like really taking your support community. When did you know you were gay? Because I always tell everybody that even from like 4 years old, I always just knew that that's how I was. I wasn't like everybody else. Did you have that kind of experience or was it like an awakening?
I think I knew probably around the age of 8, mainly because after my family finished with the Sears catalog or the JCPenney's catalog and they threw it away, I would fish it out of the trash can just because I wanted to cut out the pages of men's underwear.
It's so funny because when I was like that age and my mom would take me shopping for clothes, I would always go to the men's underwear section and I would look at all the packages and pick out my favorite package, literally.
Yes, I love it. So, you know, at that age, I wanted those pages and I couldn't explain why. I couldn't put a word to it. But I also felt that societal pressure and I knew there was something wrong with it, or at least I was being told from society at large that there was something wrong with it. So I ended up burning those pages in a coffee can in my home's basement. So I knew at a young age, but it really was, I guess, freshman year of university where I started opening the closet door a little bit, but it scared the daylights out of me. It was also the start of the HIV and AIDS crisis. Mm-hmm. And it terrified me because I thought if I kiss that cute boy on my floor that I like, I'm going to get AIDS and die.
Yeah, well, there was no information. It was just passed off as that. I mean, even the directors, the medical directors were telling people that you could get it through household contact and casual touch. And so a lot of misinformation and fear around that.
An awful lot.
Mm-hmm. So I know you can't summarize a 20-year relationship, but from the time, though, that you and John get together, what is that? How would you describe those next 20 years together? I know in your docuseries, Amend, you talked a little bit about how you two just kind of lived a normal out life and then how in that itself was radical. But how would you describe your relationship during that time?
If I could think of what a perfect relationship was before then, in my mind, that's what we lived, because we just very quickly fell in love, very quickly wanted to build a life together. And we did so many things that we liked. You know, our lives were filled with socializing with family and friends, throwing parties, travel, collecting art. So our relationship, for me, it was just fun. It was easy. It was perfect. Even though we were living in this city where we were second-class citizens, we never felt that really directly in a day-to-day basis. We just lived our lives and had fun. And within the first year, I'd say, we started talking about marriage because we wanted to have our relationship mean something, to carry legal weight.
And then if we can, what happened in 2011 that started to change that?
So early in 2011, I noticed that when John was walking around our condo, it sounded different, like one foot was slapping the floor harder than the other. And I asked if he had pulled a muscle, sprained an ankle, and he hadn't. So we expected this slapping sound to go away, but it didn't. I finally convinced him to see our doctor, and that started a several month process of doctor and specialist visits. And after he went to the third neurologist who concurred with the other two, we finally had to say, okay, it is ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease.
I mean, I don't know that you can put those emotions into words, but what was it like hearing that diagnosis?
Heartbreaking. Because ALS has no cure, there's no effective treatment, and most people die within 2 to 5 years of diagnosis. And here was the love of my life, the person my life was built around, getting this death sentence. And it was terrifying. It was heartbreaking. It was all of those horrible emotions you can imagine.
And I don't think people really understand that, you know, marriage really offers so many protections and benefits and things that you need in times like this. And people are just so ignorant to that.
Right. And one of the things John did right after he was diagnosed, he said, Jim, we're going to have to buy a new condo because the condo we lived in was an old factory. So the building itself wasn't going to be incredibly welcoming and easy for John to navigate. And our particular condo had two levels. So he said, Jim, let's find a new condo. But when we buy it, my name will not be on the deed. Only your name will be on it because I don't want you to have any issues when I'm gone. So he was already thinking of those things, the problems that I could experience as his partner of, at that point, 18 years. We weren't legally married. We had no rights. He was already thinking about those things.
And that's the thing, you know, a lot of people, especially, you know, as our younger generations come up, and me and Paul are in that generation, they don't really think and realize how many hoops people had to jump through just to make sure their partners were okay if they were gone, and that often they weren't okay, and that often they had to go through extreme measures, and even those extreme measures didn't work.
Right. Well, and here we are with John with this terminal disease, and there's also that fear if he ends up in a hospital or in a nursing facility, will I be prevented from seeing him? Will they refuse to take direction from me as his partner? And that's a very scary thing to consider. I might not be able to see him if something happens, because we had been through that once before when he respiratory arrested and he was taken to a Catholic hospital. And as his mom, brother, and I are sitting in the lobby waiting to hear if they were able to save him, all I could think was, will they let me back to see him in a Catholic hospital? Thankfully, they did, but that was a very real fear.
Mm-hmm. You, I don't know, it dropped a little around this time, but do you remember that documentary, Bridegroom?
I know of it, but I've never seen it.
Yeah, well, it's okay. You don't need it's very important, but it's very heart-wrenching. But it just reminded me, because it dropped around that time, of a similar story of a man not being able to see his partner because... because of the family and because of the fact that he had no rights, even though they had been together, I think, 6 or 7 years, and they were almost engaged. So this was the reality. And I mean, this is, like you said, by this time now you're in 2011, 2012, and then in the beginning of 2013, the Defense of Marriage Act is repealed, which, for our listeners, if you've been paying attention, you know we've talked about this, but This had been put in place in 1996 that had banned same-sex marriage federally, and now it was repealed. And what were, I know that you talked a little bit about this, but do you mind recounting that story of when you two realized that DOMA had been repealed?
Oh, happily. So in April of 2013, John started at-home hospice care. So he was completely bedridden and could do nothing for himself. And I was his full-time caregiver, other than about the 3 hours a week the nurses visited. So on June 26, 2013, John called me into his room. Well, it was the combination, his bedroom, our living room now. He called me in because news was coming out about the case United States versus Windsor. And that was a case where Edie Windsor sued the federal government to say, my marriage to Thea should exist, and I should not be billed more than $800,000 from the IRS and the state of New York on Thea's estate after Thea died, because I'm her legal spouse. So on June 26, 2013, I'm standing next to John's bed holding his hand as the news comes out that in their decision on United States versus Windsor, the Supreme Court struck down the Defense of Marriage Act. And I, without thinking about it, it wasn't planned, I just leaned over, hugged and kissed John and said, let's get married. Because knowing that DOMA was struck down, here was our first opportunity in our almost 21 years together that we could get married and have it mean something legal, have it carry legal weight, at least at the federal level. And that was what we always wanted. We wanted, if we got married, we wanted it to carry legal weight.
Right. Makes sense. That's the whole point of it. You know, and people, it's, I just always, I'm bringing this up again, but just the ignorance that people think that you don't need it, you know, it just, it's a lot.
Oh, it is. Marriage comes with it. What was it? 1300 different rights and privileges.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And people don't.
That's an awful lot.
Yeah. And with it as well as the dignity and the respect of being seen as an equal individual.
Yes.
And so then you two had to go through incredible lengths to get married. And again, I know you've told this story so many times, but do you mind telling again?
I never get tired of telling this story. So after I proposed, luckily John said yes. And my first call was to John's Aunt Paulette. Her nickname is Aunt Tootie. So I called Aunt Tootie and said, Aunt Tootie, do you remember making that offer years ago that if we could ever get married or if we ever chose to get married, you wanted to be able to do it? Well, what's your availability like? We're going to get married. And Aunt Tootie immediately said, you tell me when and where, I will be there. So then we had to figure out, how do we get John, this dying man who can do nothing for himself, to another state in order to get married? And where do we get married? So I started researching the various states where we could, and we settled on Maryland for one really, for us, important reason. Maryland was the only place that did not require both people to appear in person to apply for the marriage license. And my whole goal in this was to make sure that John was kept as safe and as comfortable as much as possible. So the fact that I could go to Maryland on my own to get the marriage license made that easier on John. So that's what we decided to do. But then to get John to Maryland, how do we do that? I couldn't take him to the Cincinnati airport and fly on Delta or American. And I wasn't willing to put him in an ambulance for that long of a drive because it would have been punishing on him. So our only option really was a chartered medical jet. So I started getting quotes. And I hate to break the surprise, but if you ever need to charter a medical jet, they're not cheap.
I was imagining.
And it was something we could afford, but I thought, you know, in this world, oftentimes it's those connections, those personal connections that can help make things better or easier. So, but the only positive thing I will say about Facebook, I went to Facebook and I posted saying, hey, John and I are going to get married. We have to charter a medical jet. Does anyone have a contact, a pilot, someone with a chartered medical jet company? Just in the hopes that it would help mitigate the cost. And the most amazing thing happened. Our family and friends started commenting, sorry, Jim, we can't help that way, but you and John deserve to get married, and we want to help make it happen, so please accept this gift of cash. And our family and friends covered the entire $14,000 cost of that jet.
Wow. That's incredible.
So we boarded that jet on July 11th, 2013, along with Aunt Tootie, and we flew to Baltimore Washington International Airport, where we landed, parked on the tarmac, and I got to take John's hand, and we got to say those words that we had wanted to say for so long. I do. I thee wed.
What was it like being able to say husband for the first time and have it mean so much?
It was amazing. I'm not kidding when I say I think John and I used the word husband hundreds of times every day. It didn't matter what I was asking. Hey, John, husband, would you like some water? We just use husband as often as we could because it felt so good.
Mm-hmm. After all that time, it's a feeling that only an LGBTQ person understands, yeah. But it's liberating. It's validating.
Yes, validating is the perfect word.
So then after that, how much longer did you and John have together?
Just a little bit over 3 months.
And it was during that time that you got contacted by Al Gerhardstein, who was reading about in your book, and then I kind of got on a trail of following his work. It seems like an incredible man, very empathetic, very passionate. And so he reaches out and says that he'd like to talk to you, right?
Correct. So we got married on a Thursday, and on Saturday, a story about us written by a friend who worked for the Cincinnati Inquirer came out online, and it was in the Sunday print edition. But Al was at a party where he ran into friends and neighbors of ours, former neighbors, who told Al about us and about how we had gotten married. So Al went to his office and started thinking, there's got to be something we can do here for them because they have a problem and they don't know it. But he also reached out to our mutual friends and asked if they would be willing to ask us if we'd be open to meeting with them. So 5 days after we got married, he came to our home and he pulled out a blank Ohio death certificate. And he said, now, guys, I'm pretty sure you haven't thought about this because you've just gotten married. So why would you be thinking about a death certificate? But do you understand that when John dies, his last official record as a person will be wrong? Ohio will fill out his death certificate and say he's single, unmarried, and Jim, your name will not be there as his surviving spouse.
What was that like?
Oh, it was heartbreaking. But I think more importantly, it made us angry. Mm-hmm. And so when Al asked if we wanted to do something about it, John and I discussed it. And John was very clear. He said, Jim, yes, I think we should. But you have to realize this is all on you because I can't do anything. So we decided, yes, let's fight this because we want our marriage to be treated with respect and dignity.
And it's just insane, like, the amount of work and struggle and effort and fight you had to have just to be recognized for your life.
Right. And it's something nobody should go through. But, you know, we lived in Ohio that had its own version of the Defense of Marriage Act. And to fight the state, to file a lawsuit against the state of Ohio and the city of Cincinnati wasn't anything I had ever dreamt of, wasn't something I ever thought I would experience. But Al is this amazing civil rights attorney, and there's something about him. He made us feel comfortable. He made us feel safe. And when he said, this is my idea, this is what we can do, for us, it was such an easy decision. And I really always look at it as filing suit was our way of living up to our promises to love, honor, and protect each other.
Absolutely.
And you had talked about before, like you mentioned in this interview already and then in other things, where you just, the two of you weren't really politically active. And then all of a sudden you are in the middle of one of the most hotly debated court cases in Ohio. Did that affect any other aspects of your life? Or was it just you knew this is exactly what you needed to do and there was no looking back and you were comfortable and confident in your decision?
Never once did I second guess that decision. But I also have to be very honest. You know, when John and I decided to do this, my world really existed of the four rooms of John's room. I couldn't think about or think beyond those four walls. Everything I did was focused on John. So deciding to file this lawsuit was just part of my focus on John. And I know at one point in the back of my mind, there was that, you know, that voice speaking up saying, Jim, I'm Jim from your high school government class. Remember, the Supreme Court is a possibility, especially because we're starting in federal district court. I heard that, but I did not pay attention to it because I was still focused on John. But it was such an easy decision to make. It was a decision I never once questioned because it was simply the right thing to do.
Yeah, and Evan and I always talk on the podcast about how queer individuals are always pushed to the point where they have nothing left to lose. And when you back somebody into that corner, there's nothing they won't do to bring about the change necessary to get what they have to get done.
Exactly. I already knew I was losing the most important person in my world. I knew that was coming. So to file suit, to begin this fight, that was nothing compared to the loss I knew was coming.
And I had pulled this this quote from Judge Black that's in your book. And Judge Black was the Cincinnati judge who was the first person to rule on your case. And I pulled it because it reminds me of you and a lot of other LGBTQ people. But he had written in his decision, "When we study the biographies of our heroes, we find that most of their lives was spent in quiet preparation, doing tiny, decent things until one historic moment catapulted them to center stage." And I felt like that I had to pull it because I felt like that was such a description of yours and John's story.
That is, and I don't remember that particular line, but it's also been many years since I've read his decision.
That's okay. I, it's nice to be reminded of those things. I just felt like it was so fitting in your book and in his decision. And now, can you walk us through what happened after that? So after you, because the Judge Black does rule in your favor, says that you can be listed on the death certificate, and then what happened?
Right. So let me also add, because I love this part of that first hearing, we filed suit against the state of Ohio and the city of Cincinnati. And we've talked a bit about how horrible Cincinnati was in, you know, up through the 90s. But Cincinnati had started to change pretty drastically. And in that first hearing in Judge Black's federal courtroom, the city solicitor for Cincinnati stood up in the courtroom and said, and I'm paraphrasing, "Your Honor, the city of Cincinnati agrees with John and Jim. Their marriage deserves to be recognized. We want nothing to do with this fight that the state of Ohio is fighting." So to me, that was this beautiful, public, obvious statement of the changes that had happened in Cincinnati. So
big moment, sure.
It really was. And, you know, I also have to say, the city council renamed the side street that our condo overlooked John Arthur and Jim Obergefell Way.
Oh, that is a beautiful tribute.
That is.
They also proclaimed our wedding day, John Arthur and Jim Obergefell Day, in the city of Cincinnati. So that's just three, four things that show you how drastically Cincinnati had changed.
It's just beautiful, that full circle, to go from, you know, living in this city that you two loved very much and having it once named the most anti-gay city, the city without empathy, I think, and then to
pity.
Now pity, the city without pity. And then now it's remembering you two and honoring all gay couples, mm-hmm, by that.
Yeah, it's really been such a delight to see a city change in so many positive ways. So we won our first hearing, that first decision from Judge Black, on July 22nd, 2013. And 3 months later to the day, John died, October 22nd. And as you can imagine, my world fell apart, and I really spent the next year running away, to be honest. I traveled a lot. I really just tried to get away from things. But the case was still happening, because after John died, the state of Ohio appealed to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. And Al Gerhardstein had a second case around marriage equality. But this one focused on birth certificates. He had six couples who had either given birth or adopted in Ohio, and they sued the state of Ohio to have their children's birth certificates be accurate and list both parents' names. Well, Judge Black heard that case as well and also ruled in their favor. So in 2014, that case plus cases from Kentucky, Tennessee, and Michigan, we all went to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in Cincinnati. And right from the start, the entire legal team said, don't get your hopes up. This is one of the most conservative circuit courts in the nation. And that was good advice because they ruled against us. It was a 3-court panel, and in a 2-1 decision, they ruled that the state of Ohio had every right to ignore our marriages, to treat us as less than. I will say, if you haven't read this, Judge Martha Daughtry, she was the dissenting judge in that decision, and her dissent is blistering.
I read her dissent, and it was, but please continue.
Oh, no. So anyway, that was the low point because, you know, here we were, we had won in federal district court, but now we lost in circuit court. But the silver lining was maybe now the Supreme Court will actually take up marriage equality and settle this once and for all, which was also a scary thing. But that's exactly what happened because the Sixth Circuit was the first appeals court to rule against marriage equality. Several others had ruled in favor. So because of that split between circuit courts, the Supreme Court accepted our appeal and our group of cases from those 4 states went to the Supreme Court.
Which I was just going to say, like, it's that thing again where you're like, you're pushing these people to the point where they don't have anything else to lose. They're just going to keep pushing back and eventually somebody's going to have to give.
Right. And I couldn't imagine stepping back and saying, I'm done. I can't continue this fight. That was never a consideration. I had to keep fighting for John.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I just admire your story so much because everyone else, I felt, you know, they're fighting for this future. They're fighting for the right to marry. They're fighting for the future with their children. And you were fighting in honor of your husband and you were fighting for what you had lost. Did you feel lonely on your journey? And what were some of the emotions around that?
There were certainly times when I felt very alone, very lonely. But I also have to say, Joe and Rob, they were part of Al's birth certificate case. They live in Manhattan, but they adopted in Ohio. And I still remember this because it was one of the most empathetic, thoughtful things I remember someone doing. When we were at the Sixth Circuit for the arguments, we all filed in, we took our seats, and I was on one side of the courtroom. Joe sat down on the other side with his husband and their son, Cooper, who at 2 years old was the youngest plaintiff. And Joe turned to Rob and said, Jim's over there by himself. I'm going to go sit with him because he doesn't have anyone else. So there were moments like that that really helped and made me feel much less alone.
And it just shows, you know, the community coming together and supporting each other. But I did want to recognize, you know, your fight was a little different than everyone else. I mean, we were going for the same things, but coming from different places. And again, just the respect for the way that you continued forward. And like you said, you did it in honor of John. But it's just wanted to say thank you for that.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
So the reason that Obergefell is on the name of the landmark decision. That is because your case was the first one presented in the Cincinnati case?
No.
Okay.
I like to joke they picked the most complicated name because I also think it would have been just beautiful had they chosen the Tennessee case. I think there were 2 Tennessee cases, and the one was Love versus Tennessee. I forget exactly what it was. So I always thought, how perfect would that be if marriage equality was love versus something when interracial marriage was loving versus Virginia?
That's true.
But it became Obergefell versus Hodges simply due to timing. The Supreme Court, when they have a consolidated case, their tradition is that they will name it after the lowest case number, i.e. the first case to file cert to appeal to the Supreme Court. And Al filed our cert with the Supreme Court 10 minutes before the Tennessee case.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
So that's why it became, right? So that's why it's Obergefell v. Hodges.
Wow.
That's crazy.
How does it feel having your name attached to such an important piece of legislation?
Surreal. And I honestly, there are times when I hear a story or I read a story and I see Obergefell used as shorthand for marriage equality, or they list Obergefell v. Hodges. I sometimes have to pinch myself and remind myself that I'm that Obergefell because it doesn't seem possible.
It will go on for centuries as cases come and go. That name, your name will forever be a monumental piece of legislation.
It makes me laugh, and I like to say I've done a good deed for every future Obergefell. More people will know how to pronounce it and spell it than ever before.
That's right. And so on June 26th, 2015, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of same-sex marriage, and you had been going to the decision days every day for a while, right?
Right. I started going back to DC in mid-June to be in the courtroom for every decision day because everyone expected this decision to come out towards the end of their term, which ends at the end of June. And I needed to be in the courtroom. So I was there on June 15th, which is a Monday, because they officially schedule decision days only on Mondays in June. They can add more days. So I was there the 15th, no decision. I was there the 22nd, no decision. But as we were in front of the courthouse on the 22nd after the hearing, someone came running out to say, well, they just added Thursday, June 25th as a decision day. And at that point, we were still thinking, well, it's going to be Monday, June 29th. But then a few moments later, another person came running out and said, well, they added Friday, June 26th as a decision day. And we all looked at each other and said, it's going to be on June 26th. At least that was our hope, because June 26th, 2013 was when the United States versus Windsor struck down DOMA. June 26, 2003 or 4, I can never remember which, was when Lawrence versus Texas, that decision struck down anti-sodomy laws. So we suddenly thought it's going to be Friday the 26th.
Can I ask, on the 26th, this is my own little personal thing, you were wearing a lavender striped bow tie, and I don't know if you remember that, but I wanted to know if that was
on
purpose. Okay, did you choose that color lavender as a symbol or...
I think so.
I don't know.
But I don't know. But okay, I'm going to say yes, I did. It was purposeful.
the color lavender is so important in queer history. And when I saw that, when I was looking at the interviews, I was like, I wonder if he did that on purpose. But
well, and especially because that morning, standing on the sidewalk in front of the Supreme Court, I was in line for the public seats. And that's where I was for oral arguments day, for every other decision day. I was just standing in line on the sidewalk. And every one of those days, a court officer would come out and hand out tickets for the public seats in the courthouse. And that happened on Friday, June 26th. He walked by handing out the tickets. And we're all just talking because it tended to be a lot of the same people who were there every day. So we'd gotten to be friends. And I looked in my hand and I'm holding my ticket for the courtroom and I realized something was different. Every other day I had been there, the ticket for the courtroom was bright orange. Well, on Friday, June 26th, it was lavender.
No.
And I said, hey, everybody, did you notice? Look what's changed. And suddenly the mood got even more optimistic because we thought this has to be a sign. There's no other reason for this ticket to have changed to the color lavender.
Yeah. Wow. That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, that's wow.
And I will say, I'm still angry, and it makes me upset that when you get to the courtroom door, they take those tickets. You are not allowed to hold on to them.
And I had
lavender ticket number one. Oh, I so wish I had it.
That would have been really great. Frame that and put it on the wall.
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you still have that lavender bow tie?
I personally do not have it currently because the museum in D.C., they closed at the end of, 2019?
Yeah.
But their last special exhibition was about LGBTQ rights. Mm-hmm. So I loaned them the bow tie, the jacket I wore when we got married, our wedding rings, which I had fused together, and some of John's ashes inset on the inside, and the street sign from Cincinnati, John Arthur and Jim Obergefell Way, that was part of their exhibition. And even though the museum has closed, that exhibition will be on tour in, I think, later this year and next year into 2023.
Wow. That is really incredible. That's amazing.
It was weird to see my things in a museum, let me tell you.
I'm sure it is. I think it's amazing. It's just wonderful to be a part of history like that. But I'm sure it is a little odd to look back and see your clothes staring back at you.
Yes.
So going back, Jim, so where are you today? Because now we are almost 6 years past that historic ruling. What are you doing today and how are you staying busy?
Well, you know, for first 3-4 years after the decision, as you can imagine, I was incredibly busy doing speaking engagements, events, traveling all over the place. During that time frame, well, even before the decision, 3 months before that, I co-founded a wine label called Equality Vines. And every wine we release is tied to an organization fighting for equality. So when we sell a bottle of that wine, we donate to that organization. And so far, we support LGBTQ organizations, women's rights organizations, and our newest line supports immigrants' rights. So that has been fun. It's been so much fun. I've learned a lot about wine. So that's kept me busy. But then I realized as time was going, and especially when I decided to move back to Ohio 2 years ago, I realized I needed to be a little more focused on what I'm doing because I was really having fun. If something came up that sounded interesting, I did that, you know, wrote a book, released a book, which was incredible. Love Wins that you mentioned. But I realized I wanted to be a little more focused. So back in September, I joined Family Equality. It's the only national organization fighting to create legal and lived equality for LGBTQ plus families. And for me, it just felt like this perfect continuation of the fight I started, that John and I started around marriage and family. So I'm working with Family Equality, and that's really been meaningful for me, but also a lot of fun. It's a great organization. You know, we're out there fighting for our families, our community, to be able to form their families in whichever way they want, whether that's fostering, adoption, surrogacy, IVF, other alternative reproductive technologies. So we do legislative and legal work. And a big part of what we do is help create community and provide resources to existing LGBTQ plus families or members of our community who want to form a family. So that's been great. And I'm trying to think, what else have I done? Amend, which you mentioned.
Yeah.
It's been fun.
Is Family Equality, is that a national organization?
It is a national organization.
Okay, and are there any bills or cases right now that are important that the public should be aware about?
Well, the one thing that we're waiting for is a decision from the Supreme Court on Fulton versus the City of Philadelphia. And in this particular case, a couple adoption and foster providers in Philadelphia have demanded the right to refuse to work with LGBTQ plus people. Now, these are agencies that are funded by taxpayer dollars. So everybody in the city of Philadelphia, in the state of Pennsylvania, they're helping pay for these agencies to advocate for kids who are looking for homes, kids who want a loving home. But these agencies want from the start to say, we refuse to even consider these people, this group of people who would be fantastic parents, who would provide loving homes for children. It also makes me wonder, how are they treating the 30% of kids in the child welfare system who are LGBTQ plus?
Probably pretty horribly.
Well, exactly.
I was going to say, my wife and I are actually foster parents. And even here in Rhode Island, which is a very liberal, progressive state, we see that all the time. We see especially trans, non-binary children who are rejected by foster families because of their LGBTQ status. We see high rates of foster children being kicked out of their homes because they are LGBTQ. So yeah, this is a huge problem. Please continue.
It's incredibly huge. And I think it's such an indictment in our society that kids are thrown out. Kids are put in danger. They become homeless simply because of who they are. And the fact that these agencies that are supposed to advocate for them, who are supposed to be doing everything they can to find a loving home for that child, for those children, would refuse to even consider working with an entire group of people. And especially when the LGBTQ plus community is 8 times more likely to foster or adopt than the straight community. Mm-hmm. And they're also much more likely to adopt and foster hard to place kids, sibling groups, children with emotional or medical issues. So it's just devastating that that's what these agencies are fighting for. So that's a decision we're really waiting for. And we're also involved in working hard to help make the Equality Act reality. You know, that would update the 1964 Civil Rights Act to include gender identity and sexual orientation. And we're also working hard on the Every Child Deserves a Family Act, which would outlaw discrimination in the child welfare system. It would outlaw conversion therapy in the child welfare system. So many other important things that would really help kids who want a loving home and also the people who want to provide a loving home.
Just like ever since, you know, you got started, you just have constantly been working to change things. And that's really incredible. Thank you.
Very inspiring. And so people can find out more at, I'm guessing, familyequality.org. Is that the website?
That's correct.
Okay. And where can they find your wine label and your wines?
You can find us at equalityvines.com. We don't have a whole lot of retail. We have some retail presence in California, Chicago, DC, and New York, but our wines are all limited release, so you can buy it all online.
All right. So I hope that people are going to be stocking up on the quality wines. And if you are a parent, please reach out to familyequality.org if you're a queer parent. And if you need more information being connected, you can always email me and Paul at Your Queer Story. You can message us on our social media, and we will be happy to put you in contact. Jim, I just want to say again, thank you so much for joining us today. This was an incredible interview, and we really appreciated a chance to hear from you, to get to know you, and again, you taking your time out of your day, especially on a weekend, to chat with us.
Well, Evan, Paul, this has been great. Thanks for having me on. And I would like to end with just this plea to everyone in our community. You know, if we're out there asking for equality for the LGBTQ plus community, we have to be advocates for everyone within our community. And I'm thinking about our transgender siblings who are being targeted and attacked, especially now across our nation. But we have to be advocates for everyone within our community. But we also have no right to demand equality for ourselves if we're not demanding it for every other marginalized community, whether that's people of color, Asian Americans, you name it. If we're not demanding equality for everyone, then we have no right to demand it for ourselves.
Agreed. Absolutely. 100%. Absolutely. And actually, you know, we talked about some of the anti-trans legislation that's been sweeping the nation, if anybody wants to stay up to date on that. But I could not agree more. It's all of us or none of us. That's how Paul and I always see it.
Yeah.
I agree wholeheartedly.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Jim.
Yeah. I just wanted to say, there were a couple points in the interview you brought tears to my eyes just hearing your story hearing your struggles and things really resonated with me. And I think that's also especially true because, you know, Evan and I are both from the Midwest, so we've seen firsthand, not necessarily to the extent that you faced, you know, around the 80s and things, but the way that society can just look at you and look at you like you're less than just for existing as you are.
Exactly. And this has been great. And Paul, I hope you and your fiance are able to schedule your wedding and have a huge celebration once this crazy pandemic and everything passes, or at least gets better.
Well, that'll happen, hopefully.
One day. All right. Well, we will let you go. And again, thank you.
Thank you. Have a wonderful weekend, Jim.
I will. You do the same. Thanks again.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Hello, Christians. We just want to remind you all that Sojourner House of Rhode Island is offering two important free national services at this time. Any person in the United States who identifies as a victim of domestic violence, sexual assault, and/or human trafficking can take part in their free virtual support groups every Monday and Tuesday. It's a healthy and accessible way for victims to find support, especially during this time of uncertainty due to COVID-19. The other service they're offering is a free at-home HIV testing kit. In order to receive yours, you simply have to send in a request to khawkins@sojournerri.org. That's khawkins@sojournerri.org and set up a brief consultation. Then a test will be shipped to your home free of charge, and you can self-administer and receive results within 20 minutes. After a few days, a Sojourner House representative will contact you just to make sure you have all the resources you need. There's no payments or further stipulations required for anyone receiving this important service. So connect with Sojourner House today and send in your request for support. If you have trouble getting through, then feel free to message Paul and Evan at yourqueerstory@gmail.com or message us on any social media platform at yourqueerstory. Thanks for listening. Remember to subscribe and review wherever you are listening and follow us on social media at yourqueerstory.
Like what you heard? Want to share your story? Send us a voice message to add to the podcast from the Anchor app or at anchor.fm/yourqueerstory.
And if you would like to support the work we do or get exclusive content, check us out on patreon.com/yourqueerstory.
See you next week.
Bye.